21st Century Radio is sponsored by Hieronymus & Company. Now more of 21st Century Radio with your host, Dr. Bob Hieronymus.
Look up your chimney, the sky ain't blue, it's kind of yellow, you know it's true.
Well, there's the Traveling Wilburys again, and they're trying to tell you something here. They're trying to tell you that something's wrong with our climate, and that's something our present president doesn't think we're in bad shape at all. As a matter of fact, that's why I think he's in love with Exxon and the president of Exxon, who is being sued in New York City and elsewhere in regards to what's going on with our problems with the planet, which are very serious. Now, we're back with 21st Century Radio and our guest Andy and Celeste Gurevich from Portland here to tell us why it's so important to learn more about the goddess. But before we do that, there is something I need to talk to you about, and it deals specifically with my feelings about the Statue of Liberty, because it's kind of key. It's kind of key to our life. And, you know, one of the things that I've always found fascinating is the popularity of the Statue of Liberty. The Statue of Liberty is in about 25 different nations. You see it all over the world, everywhere that by and large, China especially, but everywhere except for Russia. You may have noted that. 25 other nations of the world, and even China, but absolutely not in Russia. Now, there's very good reason for that, because they do not believe in the liberty of the people. They believe in the liberty of their president. And I think that that's one of the biggest problems that we're going to have in the future, because we have a president that actually thinks that's the way to go. I don't. However, in regards to our guest tonight, we were talking a little bit about the importance of ancestor worship in caves, and then we got to the point where of ancient cultures being animistic, acknowledging the existence of spirit in all living things, but they also recognized the feminine principle as primary for life, spirituality, and consciousness. She represented abundance, new life, and fertility, and she was the ground of our mythological being. Now, what about horse worship and partnership? What have you learned about sacrifice in regards to this?
If we can go back to something quickly, we just heard in your news segment that giraffes are going to go on the endangered species list here soon. And to think about this beautiful animal maybe exiting the planet for good. If you want to look at a symbol for how we violated our covenant with the sacred mother and with the natural world, I think that's really it. And another one comes to mind from your theme music. You know, I love the music that you've been playing tonight. And when you play the Wilburys, it makes me think of in the news of Bob Dylan's acceptance of the Nobel. He sends Patti Smith. You want to talk about somebody grounded, a manifested, embodied version of the sacred feminine, and she goes and performs A Hard Rain's Gonna Fall. And so a song that is prophetic as any that Dylan ever wrote about the times we're currently in, and brought to that Nobel committee, not by Dylan himself, but by Patti Smith. And so this is akin to Brando sending that Native American woman to the Academy Awards to accept his award. It was huge. Hugely symbolic.
Well, sir,
for what it's worth, yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, I think we're probably dealing with the kind of quality of consciousness of our president that I don't think he gives a goddamn about other animals and living things like that. I think he's really in it for the money. I think that's his main interest. As you can see, I'm not biased at all.
yeah, not at all.
Well, us either, really. You know.
Yeah.
And to finish up what we were talking about before the break, just about ancestor worship, and we can tie in the horses at any, you know, maybe at some point after that. If you are venerating your ancestors, because that's where you come from, and so it's a veneration. You know, again, we say the word worship, but it's a veneration of that which you, comes before you, that which you came from. And in cultures that viewed time in terms of cycles, they represent not only the past but the future, because that which was before will be coming, will be coming again, right? And a way to think about this is in terms of like the seasons, right? And so right now we're experiencing winter, and if I want to think about you know, the season that just came, the fall, if I want to think about, you know, what life in the fall, I could think about that in terms of the past, but I can also think about it in terms of the future. I can think about fall 2017 and what that might be like, right? And so in the same sort of way, your connection to the lives around you exists in that sort of past, present, future, all at the same time kind of way. Now, when you add in this element of the sacred feminine, what Margaret Mead and these folks spoke about was this idea. I mean, if you think about it this way, we didn't really understand even how babies were sexed, even in the time of Henry VIII, right? It was in the 1600s when we still didn't have a clear idea where a baby's sex came from. So when you go further back, the suggestion is that we had no idea that men were involved in procreation at all. What the mythology seems to teach, and when you realize this, then a lot of the patriarchal mythologies that start emerging in the Fertile Crescent start to make sense when you read their creation narratives. What it seems to have been believed in the Neolithic and Paleolithic was that a woman's at a certain point in her life, she would start her monthly cycle, and then at some point, for some unknown reason, right, and there's lots of different explanations for this, her blood would stop flowing and it would start clotting up in her belly. And then 9 months later, a baby would come out, which was the product of that clotted up blood, right? But there was no awareness that men had anything to do with this process. There was no awareness that you know, intercourse was the product or the result of this. And so when you start thinking about venerating the ancestors in terms of regeneration, of the next generation venerating that which they came from, then they're looking back to the mothers of the previous generation, not for their co-participation in the creation of that generation of people, but for their sole participation in the creation of people, right? And so then you go back another generation, and it's the same thing. It's the sacred mothers and grandmothers, and you go back, and this is, again, mother, maiden, crone. You go back another generation and another, and if the idea is that originally, as we see in Chauvet, everything emerges from one sacred mother, right? Eventually, you're going to get back to the mother of all. Eventually, that goes back generation after generation to the one individual, either mythologically or actually, that all of the living were of your tribe and of the planet were born from, the body from which all things, all life emerged. And so ancestor worship in this capacity becomes a veneration of this sacred feminine life-giving principle, this principle of regeneration that has us existing in these transforming relationships of being grandparents and then dying and becoming children again.
Well, we're headed towards something that I've been wanting to talk about for about 3 months.
Hmm.
And that is actually not, I just exaggerated that. But I've never exaggerated anything in my life.
Or this one either.
No wonder we get along so well.
All right. But, you know, how can we incorporate these lessons about goddess worship into our modern lives? For example, I want to hear more about, as Andy put it, goddess worship is an ancient technology meant to trigger the empathic drives of our collective right hemispheres. How can we activate this today? Because we sure as hell need it now.
Well, okay, well, I guess I would speak of myself personally and the ways that I choose to use the sacred feminine to, you know, in integrative ways in my life, especially when it comes to my art and my activism. I am a mother and grandmother myself, and so I understand the Ursa mythology and the cave bear, identification for fierce protectiveness, fierce protective nurturing, and, you know, it seated in a being of immense power, and the ways that, you know, human women have always identified with these kinds of animals, in that, you know, the day after, you know, the election, it would have been so easy to just fall into that initial impulse that was out of fear and the unknown and, you know, a sense of terror. But what helped me shift that was the cave bear ferocious energy that was coming from some of my mentors and sister friends and my husband and our, you know, members of our community. And that helped me tap into that really calm, calculating ferociousness that that I identify with cave bears, and with the ongoing symbols of the sacred feminine that I've been studying since I was a teenager, that have always embodied those qualities. And that helps me inform my art and my activism and the way I'm a member in the community and the energy that I encourage in other people.
Mm-hmm. For me, it has to do with this embracing of other. I'm trying to move beyond tolerance to a real embracing of those outside of my own frame. I think social media has done a lot of wonderful things and made a lot of wonderful connections, but it's also allowed us to create these kind of virtual echo chambers where we slice and dice and block and unfriend anything that doesn't exactly represent our own personal worldview. And so we end up sort of with this like huge digital footprint of the ego. And for me, this goes back to a kind of Aristotelian notion. There's a couple of things here that I think really matter. Like, they really matter for how we're going to go forward together. And one of them has to do with this idea that when we engage people's ideas, you know, there's that old movie Highlander about the guys that go through time fighting each other. And there's the phrase, there can be only one, right? There has to be this winner. And that to engage people in a kind of verbal match, there has to be a winner and there has to be a loser. And so people have learned this kind of this ranking, that you come into a conversation and in order to create the space, in order to say what you need to say, you have to negate something first, right? We have to carve out the experience of others in order to justify what it is that I want to say, or there can be only one answer to, so why did Hillary lose? Don't tell me it was millennials, it was white women. Don't tell me it was that, it was this. And everyone's looking for the silver bullet, the one answer. And this is a very Aristotelian, right? This comes from a foundational notion in Western civilization, which decided early on to prioritize the left hemisphere of the brain and its operations over whole brain mentations, which involves both. So when I told you earlier about that scientist saying, as I'm studying these things and going into this cave, I'm having all of this profound emotion and it's messing with my dreams and it's messing with my waking self and I'm in tears and he's pushing all of that away from his analysis because he's been trained to do that. We've all been trained to do that over thousands of years, that if something is true, it means something else must not be true. And so I'll give you a perfect example of what I mean. I teach a writing class at the college where I work, and we've been studying the prison system. And one of the things that I have students write about is they pick topics and go write about the prison system. And I have several papers that come in from my more right-wing leaning students, and they want to talk about, look, we need to have a conversation about personal responsibility. People need to be held accountable for their actions. Families need to be teaching children how to behave properly. Communities need to take responsibility for themselves, and people need to learn to obey the law and to live noble lives. And now I don't disagree with any of that, right? Now my more liberal leaning students will come in and say, we have to have a conversation about systematic racism and mass incarceration. We have to have a conversation about how certain communities are perpetually generationally disempowered, that the committing of crimes is not a character flaw or a genetic thing, but is a result of horribly racist economic policies that have left families and communities disenfranchised for generations. And I agree with all of that as well. right now in the current political climate, I must choose one or the other. I have to choose one narrative to support and exploit and defend, or the other, right? Because that's the system that we have. It's this Aristotelian either-or system. Whereas in something that leans more towards a goddess awareness, a goddess orientation, I don't have to pick these airtight, conscripted, ranked categories. That I could apply both. I could look at both things and say, how can we enhance our communities in both of these directions at the same time? It's not an either-or orientation. It's both and. How do we look at the systematic failure and systemic structures in our culture and how they failed certain communities, and how do we empower people and families and communities to take more responsibility for themselves and live better, more fulfilling, and yes, more law-abiding lives?
We're up upon our break here on this hour, first break. And when we get back, there's somebody that I know who said to worship the goddess politically is to acknowledge and protect the commons, and to expand them to include education, health care, safe food, clean water, and sustainable economic opportunity for all. I believe this guy is right. I think I'm a little bit biased along these lines. And my fear is this.
Sounds like a handsome fella.
Well, yes, he is. As a matter of fact, he is. It's,
not at all.
He's my brother. That's right. Now, I've been looking at the apocalypse for a long time. As you guys know, I don't know if I sent you a copy of the Apocalypse Mural Guide.
Mm-hmm.
But back there in 1968, it became evident to me at that time that we have lost control of our government from the standpoint of corporate structures taking over.
Man.
That the 1% at that time in 68 were in a dominant position, and it's been nothing but the same again. Now we're involved with a corporate president, with corporations running pretty much everything, and I don't believe it's going to be easy for the commons to expand and include education, health care, safe food, clean water. Clean water is going to cost us plenty, and we're not going to have much of it with fracking going on and being pushed to the nth degree. When we return, let's touch on some of these particular problems, which I think are going to plague us for quite a while.
Yeah, this is Ziggy Marley saying love, and you're listening to 21st Century Radio with Dr. Bob Hieronymus. One love, y'all.
Well, this is one of the most interesting interviews, you know. Over the years, I've been doing interviews, but this one is very special.
Well, it's Uncle Ziggy there, and it's about time for him to come back on the show sometime in the future so we can have a good time twisting the night away. Hey, this isn't quite his kind of music. I hope he's got his button. Hey, Ziggy. You might be listening tonight. So, have you did you get your Christmas present yet? Huh? And what about the stuff for the babies? Did you check that out too? He's probably playing with them himself there. Well, okay. Now that what kind of music was that? Hey, do you guys know what kind of music that was?
Oh, smooth jazz.
Oh, very smooth jazz.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, we need a lot of smooth talking these days. Now, guys, there. You probably realize that I'm a little bit frustrated over the last 40 years or so watching all this. And I'm so sorry it took everybody such a long time to realize that we're in deep trouble.
Yeah,
and yet
man.
We can, and yet we're denying it. There's many, many other groups that are denying it. And what do you mean by the 50 Shades of Gaia, the piece you wrote for The Economist? Can you talk a little bit about that, please?
Yeah, sure. You know, that came when you mentioned the quote before the break about the commons, and you know, the radio host Tom Hartman has been a real influence in my life, and we've struck up a sort of long-distance friendship over the years, and he speaks regularly on his program about the sacred feminine in Washington, D.C., and the goddess tradition there, along the lines of the things, many of the things in your wonderful book. And what this has to do with is just an examination of what we've been talking about, and that's the Earth itself. When we talk about Mother Earth, right, again, these things can be very esoteric. That we were, you know, a lot of times we're talking about thousands of years ago and cave paintings and Artemis and you know, and you'd say all these things, and the question you asked was very real and very practical, a kind of so what? What does this all mean for our lives? What does this all mean in the here and now? In a practical sense, and you took it to the very place it needs to go, and that's to the commons. What does it mean to be citizens of the earth? It means that we have an inherent right, I believe, to breathe and to have water and nourishing food, not just handed to us. We all need to participate in some way or another in what it means to get those things and produce those things, but we're the only animal that charges rent to itself, right? I mean, I think about this all the time when we go to the Oregon coast and we watch the whales migrating up and down the Oregon coast, from Mexico to Canada. I always think that no one's stopping them and asking them for identification.
Yeah, they should. They better get out there and do that.
Yeah, you know what I mean? There might be terrorist whales.
They might soon.
Hmm. Yeah, exactly. They're going to build a wall to stop the whales from going, right? But for some reason with people, we want to limit our movement around the earth. We want to charge access, you know, for access to housing and for food and water. We want to take these things that are just our birthright and lock them up and charge people for them. By the way, the collective knowledge of human experience and human truth is also our birthright. And that's why these sites, these sacred sites, including places like Chauvet, I profoundly disagree that they belong to any one country, any one government, or any one religion, that these things belong to all people. And so when I wrote 50 Shades of Gaia, I was in the same kind of frustration that place that you are. And I was just thinking about the environment, and I was thinking about in materialist, unhinged, sort of rabid capitalist societies, things like clean air and clean water are called externalities. They aren't factored in to how the economic model is put together. And that this is not sustainable for quality of life, and indeed not sustainable for life itself. Not even quality of life, right? And so we need a radical revisioning of capital and of the way capital works, and in the way capital just mows through resources that actually belong to the collective. You know, and again, a real boots on the ground version of what we're talking about is Standing Rock. I mean, you can't get a more embodied version of this very thing, right? The safety, these people have been moved around for centuries. We violated every treaty with them, and now they're one water source. We've already had several pipelines bust up in North Dakota.
In North Dakota,
right? And contaminate water there. Yeah. This is their only source of clean water. And the white citizens of Bismarck said they weren't going to have it happen to them, and so this was moved over indigenous land. And so these kinds of things, I wrote 50 Shades of Gaia trying to address the commons, trying to address this thing of, as citizens of the planet, what are we entitled to? And education is a bedrock of a democracy. And if you want free people, you have to educate them. And you can't educate them if they don't have a place to sleep and then something to eat and water. And so these things are connected, right? If we want a thriving and a world where people are meeting their full potential and contributing, we need these things.
I also have a second to that. I think that enacting the sacred feminine is also the step of, once Standing Rock was established and the fight was really getting intense, the move to take the money out of the major banks who are supporting anything having to do with the pipeline is a huge enactment to me of the both and model of boots on the ground where it's going to hurt the most. Hit the money sources. If everyone who disagreed went tomorrow to Wells Fargo and Chase Bank and pulled their money out and told them exactly why they were doing that, those banks are listening. And those are ways that we can manifest this into real action that actually can get some results.
And I'll add something quickly about 50 Shades. I wrote that piece trying to explain mythologically the psychology, from a mythological standpoint, the psychology of the climate change denial movement, which is coming back again full swing. You understand why, you know, somebody who's the CEO of Exxon or who runs this pipeline company, why they, what their motivation is. And it's, if they have control over billions of dollars of assets, they want to pull that out of the ground and turn it and liquefy it, turn it into capital, right? That's no surprise. But I was fascinated at the millions of people who aren't benefiting from that. But who don't believe in climate change, where does that come from? And I was tracing it back to this mythological idea that exists within many Abrahamists, you know, Jews, Christians, and Muslims, especially American Christians, two things: that the world isn't going to end until God wants it to end. And by the way, when it does, that isn't such a bad thing, because then all of us believers are going to go to heaven. And so trying to speak to people that come from that worldview about impending environmental apocalypse is pointless, because they don't believe it can happen and they don't believe it's such a bad thing anyway. And I sent it to Bill McKibben, and what I said at the time was, unless we can get people to make nature their religion again, and they can get as upset about what happened in the Gulf of Mexico with BP as Muslims do when you draw a cartoon of the prophet, then we have no hope. And Bill McKibben wrote me back, and I was amazed that he read it, and he said he thought I was being too hard on the Bible, which was hilarious. He's a Sunday school teacher, but he's a great environmental activist. And he said, you're not going to get billions of people to walk away from their faith. He suggested that I instead try to engage them from within the faith systems they're in, rather than trying to ask them to walk away from them wholesale. So that's been, and it's actually good advice. I don't disagree with the point I was making in 50 Shades of Gaia, but what I've been doing since is trying to do that. I've been engaging my more conservative-minded friends, trying to get them into a conversation about conservation and about stewardship of the environment. Because if you go backwards with them in conversation and not forwards, you have much better chance of getting their support in an environmental conversation. If you talk to them about your God created this, you know, we made Walmart, but God made giraffes. And so by letting them go extinct to build Walmarts, it's a form of idolatry. And when I can frame it that way to my more right-leaning friends, then they're suddenly engaged in the conversation.
Well, there is one thing that I think our new president is a little bit better than most who are at the extreme right. I do believe he does not support the separation of, he does support the separation of church and state. When you get to the extremist Christians, especially down there in Texas, you know, these individuals who like to look and tell their history by talking about human beings being alive at the same time of dinosaurs. I guess you're aware of their view of history is considerably different than what education,
yes, sir,
is. I mean, it's very different, and it's intentionally that way, and they have individuals that they prize those kind of ideas a great deal. But the goal of these extremist Christians, and I've been talking about this for decades, is to eliminate the separation of church and state, so that we do have a Christian nation. And I don't mean a Roman Catholic nation or a Baptist nation or a Methodist. Their view of a Christianity has nothing to do and would not accept any of the other Christian traditions. It is a warrior type. Remember Jesus, what was that little film? Jesus Camp.
Yeah, that came out.
I mean, you know, yeah. you have Sarah Palin and her friends so deeply involved in training children to go to war for the next Christian war, 3, 4, 5 years old. I'm so glad that they finally called up to them and slam dunked them pretty good, but the extreme right does not believe in the separation of church and state. And that is my greatest fear.
You make a good point. And the really unfortunate thing there, and I just brought up Tom Hartman a bit ago, this is a point he makes all the time, the separation of church and state is actually something to protect them both. And I speak to my religious friends about this all the time. I know a couple of these people that you're talking about in Texas and in Arizona. I have a friend who's a pastor in Arizona who absolutely wants the wall between church and state torn down. And we talk, I talk to him all the time. My blood pressure goes through the roof. I really got to watch it. I have a blood pressure cuff right next to my computer because I got to watch it when I'm talking to this guy. I really do. But I will say this. The real downside to this thinking is it's really short-sighted, and it has and it's also anemic in its understanding of history. Because, yeah, sure, that will work as long as your guy's in charge. But once you tear that wall down between church and state, then whoever gets in charge next can institute their religious teachings over the state, right? So if you're afraid of Sharia law in the United States, no better way to get that here than to overturn this traditional wall between church and state in terms of how the government functions. Because, I mean, this is what we had in Europe, right? The Catholics were in charge, and so they set about massacring all of the... In the Middle Ages, they killed everybody else, right? So anybody who wasn't a Christian in Christian Europe was murdered already by 1300. And so from 1300 forward, it just becomes about which kind of Christian you are. And so the Protestants take over and they murder all the Catholics. The Catholics take over and they murder all the Protestants, right? And then, so, I mean, if we want that same thing to start happening here again, then go ahead and institute a state religion.
Well,
right?
Yeah, that's exactly what will happen. Because...
But within 6 years, it's going to turn on you, right? So if the Baptists
Correct.
Are the ones who kick it in, within 20 years, we're going to be murdering Baptists in the streets because an Episcopalian's going to take over. Right, or something, right? And then it's going to be payback time for all that stuff the Baptists did.
Well, fortunately, the Baptists aren't so deeply involved in most of what we're talking about.
I meant that as a foreign instance.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
No, don't send me hate emails.
Yeah.
But unfortunately, the media, of course, does not cover that. It does not really discuss that. We have a few people in the media that would talk about it, but it is extremely important at this time because we have a no-hold-barred presidency right now. As we just heard on the news, he's not going to take advice from those who are in charge of updating him.
I'll tell you something interesting about him real quick. I'm sorry, and then Celeste. As I was thinking about it, you know, you see the interviews with him in his house there in New York, and all the chairs are made of gold. Everything's made of gold. All the doors are made of gold. And then, you know, this history of him with, as you've alluded to in our conversation with women, especially younger women, and that's come out in a lot of these stories. And again, as a professor of mythology and religious studies, I was just speaking with a group of people about this recently, about dragons. And with dragons, we have, in ancient lore, dragons guard hordes of gold and human female virgins. Now, a dragon has no use for either of those two things, right? They're guarding them from us, and particularly guarding them from power-hungry men, right? Because when violent, power-hungry men get a hold of both of those things, human female virgins and hordes of gold, they tend to lose their mind and to slash and burn everything in their way to get more and more and more of it. So the dragon is actually a buffer. Right, a dragon, this mystical creature, symbolic of the archaic religions and connection to the sacred feminine, is a symbol of guarding man from these dark impulses that, when unleashed, can devour the entire society.
Well, we need to take our final break of the hour on 21st Century Radio with our guests, Dr. Andrew Gurevich and Celeste. What a name, Celeste. Boy, I wish we had time to do name analysis. Have you looked up the name Celeste and find out its meaning, Celeste?
I have. It means a couple of different things in a couple of different languages. Of course, there's the Latin root, you know, that extends to celestial, meaning the heavens. There's also a color of blue. There's a particular type of piano that's called a Celeste. So there's a really wide category.
I wonder if there's wide categories on Andrew. Andrew, have you studied your name? I don't believe you.
You know, I have, and I couldn't tell you for the life of me what it means right now.
Well,
I think it means one who is forgetful.
Well, you just flunked the test. You gotta study these things. They're real important, all these symbols. Time out here on the playing field on 21st Century Radio with our guests, and we'll be back in just a few minutes.
Radio's Hieronymus and Company, where knowledge comes first. And now, here's something I hope you really like.
Wow, it's so good. It's so good to hear her voice again. You know, it's wonderful when you look back over your life, the number of people that cheered you up. Rocky and Bullwinkle were big. Pogo was great. Hey, have you guys ever heard of Pogo?
Pogo,
yes.
Yeah.
Walt Kelly and Pogo?
Yes.
Barely, it's reaching back.
Yeah, that's pretty vague, but yes.
Well, I'm an old man, so, you know, I'm probably about 20 years older than you guys.
Well, I feel probably 20 older than you, so.
So there. You're trying to get even, huh? Well,
I was just laughing, actually, in that last segment, how I talked right over the top of Celeste, and I chuckled during the break at how the irony of two old guys like us going on and on about the sacred feminine, and the only woman in the room can't get a word in edgewise.
Well, it's all her fault. She should have, of course, it's not. Can't be our fault. I mean, come on.
She doesn't have to speak. She embodies the wisdom.
Yeah.
Oh, there.
Now, you know.
Kidding, of course.
Now,
well, I'm not. I do, but I mean, I like her joke.
Thank you.
Here's another mouthful of a title. You ready for this one? The Sacred Marriage of Visible Logos and Epigenetic Consciousness, A Paradigm for a New Humanity, published in Reality Sandwich. Now, tell us, what are you talking about here?
Boy, you know, that's a great question. I wish we were out of time so I wouldn't have to try to remember what I was talking about there. I wrote that when I was really full of myself. I think I was trying to get money for that graduate degree and use all these.
Well, that sounded like a PhD doctoral thesis there.
Yeah, you know, and I had a lot of people write me going, nice try, buddy. You're using a lot of big words and you don't know what you're talking about. But it comes from this. It comes from this idea that it really came from two places. One was from George Orwell. And another place was from this emerging science of epigenetics and how things in our surroundings can affect genetic expression, right? And how various things in our what's the word I'm looking for? So you know the nature nurture argument. So how culture affects genetic expression, and I said, wait a minute, you know, language is a product of culture. Right. And as a reflector of it. And so if language is a product of culture and culture can affect genetic expression, then the way we language things can actually do more than just simply define them and can actually participate in this back and forth in terms of turning different genes on and off. Right. And this is something that, as far as I know, that's still just barely being studied. You know, people can call it a lot of different things, power of positive thinking, placebo effect, or whatever, but the power of language to alter reality, to alter our reality, you can see it in this last election cycle, is huge. And so I wrote that piece just really trying to explore a little bit this very issue. How can we sort of bring together sacred marriage goes back to this old religious concept of again, marrying the sacred feminine to its masculine sun consort, to its counterpart. And so I was really looking at how can we try to bring language back from the brink, right? Because as all of these other systems, human systems of thinking and action have become unhinged over the past couple of thousand years, our linguistic systems have as well. And the way words refer to things and the way words dehumanize and the way words segregate and these categories I've been talking about, Democrat, Republican, Christian, Jew, Texan, right? These phrases, we vegetarian or something, you know, we come up with these words and we create these airtight categories and then diminish the complexity of human experience to that word. And it's become a very damaging and kind of anemic way to live. And so that article is just trying to unpack a little bit of that and go under the hood and see if there's a way to put some color back into the use of language.
Well, listen to this one. It is the goddess, not the god, who is the symbol of creation and life in most of the tribal societies of prehistory. She is the author of consciousness, or as Buckminster Fuller calls her, the architect of culture. How is the goddess the architect of culture? Celeste, would you like to handle that one?
Sure. I have never had the chance to comment on his articles, as much as I am tonight. Well, let me see. As we all know, goddess is representation of literal mother as well as figurative mother. And I think that our own mothers are who introduce us to the world of our own particular cultures the most, in my opinion, for the most part. I mean, so there are exceptions in tribal society where that's more balanced, but more kind of traditional, religious family styles. But I think overall, to me, the idea of goddess and culture does come from literally the most important figure in our human experience, shaping the way that we come into our own particular cultures and communities.
Yeah, everybody comes from a mother. And when we remember that, when we remember this idea, in the Mahabharata, when Arjuna is looking out over the battlefield and sees that and loses his nerve and doesn't want to fight because he realizes that both sides of the battle are his family, and Krishna says he has to go through with it anyway to restore Dharma. This is a lesson we've forgotten. Genetics has taught us that all people come from the same two humans genetically in the Rift Valley in Africa 175,000 years ago. So literally any time we are fighting with somebody, we are fighting with a family member. And to just break it down to the family level, people are born of a mother and they're a child. And even Jesus was a child at some point and had a mother and had to be fed and changed and nurtured. And the whole conception of self emerges through interaction with the mother. And that starts from conception, by the way, right? And so our whole identity is and our whole perception of ourself in relationship to other and so much about who we are in the world is established in that primary relationship. Sure, fathers are incredibly important and teach us much as well, but that is a secondary impulse. Freud went into this, right? Right. As much as I disagree with Freud on a lot of things, I agree with him completely on some, and that's the whole conception of eros, of love of self and other emerges from one's relationship to the sacred feminine. There simply isn't a self without that. And if there's not a self, there's not a self that can create culture, because culture is a product of the self engaging and manipulating its environment expressively.
Well, you mentioned St. Columba as an antecedent to the American liberty goddess named Columbia. Now, I like this lineage a lot more than the one that says her name comes from Christopher Columbus. What more can you tell us about St. Columba as it relates to the American liberty goddess?
Yeah, my background here is small. And so it's been a while since I've looked over that piece, believe it or not. I think I wrote it in 2012. But I know that the one school of thought is that this was a feminized version of Christopher Columbus's name, but the other one goes back to some amalgamation of the Indian goddess of Libertas and then Saint Columba. And all I know of Saint Columba was that this was a Spanish missionary that was that worked with the poor, right? And beyond that, my mind is going on that. And so you might have some more to add on that, Bob. But again, what I love about it is that these are emblems of service.
Right.
Right. And so what Hartman talked about and others is that by populating Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia, with these statues on all of the buildings, what you're saying to people is when you're coming here to do the work of the people. You're coming here not to enrich yourself, not to enrich your buddies, not to enrich your cronies, but you're coming here to set aside selfish goals and work on behalf of all people.
Well, we just got about a minute left, but just tell us a little bit more about your podcast, On the Block, and what projects are coming up on your two horizons.
Okay, well, I'll quickly tell you about On the Block, and then maybe Celeste can tell you a little bit about the great show that she's working on now as well.
Okay.
As I told you, I've been blown away and blown open by this election and felt really motivated to keep trying to use the show to tell stories of transformation in the world. And so we have an old friend who's a Christian pastor named John Voles coming on the show. We have an activist, an author, an actress who's doing a lot of work in helping young girls dealing with sexual assault named Rima Zaman coming on the show. We just had a guy named David J. Brown who's done a lot of amazing work in psychopharmacology and studying entheogens and psychoactive plants. And so we are all over the map. We have the great mystic Andrew Harvey coming up, as well as Rabbi Joel Bask, who's done some amazing work in the study of DMT.
We got
endogenous DMT.
We got less than a minute now. Celeste, what would you want to add there?
Well, my primary work, besides writing my own pieces and getting them published and doing public readings continuously and studying writing, is the Bread and Roses radio show that I just started as a collective member and did the host production on my first episode, which is on KBOO.org under the Bread and Roses archives. And it's with a group of ladies, the editor and writers from a smoking new hot anthology called City of Weird, 30 Otherworldly Portland Tales, and it's a fantastic book getting a ton of press, and they're amazingly talented women, and we got to sit down and have a lot of fun in the studio. So I'm just calling my community for guests and, you know, guest suggestions from people and continuing on in my new radio adventures.
And that's ontheblockradio.com, ontheblockradio.com. Thank you for joining us here on 21st Century Radio.
Talk and breaking news on Talk Radio 680 WCBM Baltimore and WCBM.com.
Fox News Radio.